The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Denise Stoner. Denise has been associated with the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, for the past 21 years. She has been chief investigator, assistant state director, Florida's state director, and assistant director to the Experiencer Resource Team. She has an education background in business and psychology and is a certified hypnotist specializing in forensic regressive hypnosis. Denise spent 12 years with the U.S. Navy doing background investigations for new recruits wanting to enter the nuclear power school. Her involvement in the UFO field spans from more than 40 years. She co-authored and published her first book, The Alien Abduction Files, released in 2013, with Kathleen Martin, whom we just had on the show back in March of this year. She's been interviewed on numerous TV and radio shows in the past, and I'm happy to include We Are Not Alone today. So welcome to the show, Denise.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's our pleasure. So tell us, when did your experience with the extraterrestrial phenomenon first begin?
It first began for me, and it's hard for people to understand or believe, I was 2.5 years old. And how do I know that? Is for the first time, my mom was not there with me. I was being babysat by my grandfather, and my grandparents lived with us. My mom was in the hospital giving birth to my sister. So I can recall enough of that that I know what happened. I remember my grandfather's face clearly when he saw what I was watching. We were watching a huge egg-shaped object outside the window of a small living room, a playroom. He was doing the dishes, and I was standing on the sofa peeking through the blinds where we had a vacant lot at the time. And I was just watching, and as a child, I remember thinking it was Humpty Dumpty. And I thought,
egg-shaped, right?
Yeah, where's his nose and eyes and all of that? So my grandfather came through to check on me. And I said, look, Humpty Dumpty, what's he doing up there? And I remember him looking, and I remember a look of fear on his face because this thing was that close. It was just above the telephone wires right outside the window.
Right.
And he had fought in World War I in the trenches. Mm. And so he pretty strong. They called him the little warrior because he was fairly short. And so he said, let's go upstairs and get you ready for bed and read the story. So he took me upstairs and went to bed. He read the story. And I was looking around because my wallpaper was filled with nursery rhyme characters. So I started to look for Humpty Dumpty. Mm. And I didn't have him in my wallpaper. But while I was watching, a small entity stepped out through the wall.
Your grandfather was in the room at the time?
No, he was downstairs at this point. I think he was down checking on the thing that was outside the window.
Humpty dumpty, yeah.
So in just less than a minute, this little figure that was dressed like a kind of like a monk. He had a hood, he had a rope around his waist, and he was carrying a long, narrow tool or light of some sort because it had a little light on the tip of it. He walked up to my bed, and he was so tiny, no taller than me at the time at 2.5, that I wasn't afraid of him. And he came out of that wallpaper, and I thought, well, that's good. But he came and stood right next to me up near my head, and I looked into the hood that was over his head and saw the eyes of what we call the grays. Great big dark eyes. He just nodded, but I got the impression or message from him that he wanted me to go with him. And I said, okay. So he actually took my hand, helped me out of bed, and we went out into the hallway. We had three bedrooms upstairs, my grandparents in the middle, my parents at the end. And, of course, they weren't there, just my grandfather downstairs. My grandmother was still working. So we walked out into the hallway, and he took that long tool and touched it to the wallpaper, and we walked right through it, right through the wall, and ended up in a huge circular room with a bench that was attached for seating to the wall. There were no seams, no nuts and bolts, none of that. It was all a part of the whole, the floor of the wall, this bench. And I looked around, and I saw children sitting way at the far end, another little entity standing with what appeared to be a clipboard, walking back and forth in front of them. I couldn't hear him. I wasn't getting any message from him. And the little one that took me said, I want you to see. There's nothing to be afraid of, but I'd like you to come back again. He took me back through the wallpaper, saw me to my room, and then he walked back through the nursery rhyme wallpaper and disappeared.
Were you able to get to sleep after that? Do you remember?
Yeah, I did. I slept really well, whether I had some assistance somehow, or I just went to sleep, and the next thing I knew, it was morning.
Yeah, you probably didn't get any assistance from whomever, you know, after such a grueling episode, shall we say. I just wanted to say, you know, I've heard many times, even my sister's was an abductee. They're not interested in her anymore. She's 80.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, she's talked about, and many others have talked about that bench that you talk about.
Oh.
People sitting on that bench, you know, kind of waiting their turn.
Yeah, it seemed like it.
Maybe.
True.
Do you think that they examined you at that time, or it was just
no
introduction?
Right, I think so, yes. I had no fear. I had no worries. None of that. There was no expectation of, what are they going to do to me now, or what's next, or, all those anxiety-ridden thoughts didn't happen.
I think that's why they take kids that age to kind of get them acclimated to that situation so they're not afraid in the future.
Yeah, I would say that's true. A lot of people don't have anything other than a little flash of memory of that time, but I had kind of the target picture of, my mom's gone for the first time and what's happening, and expected them to bring home a little brother. She was a little sister. But, there wasn't any fear. It was a preparation, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably it. So, can you share any other of your personal abduction experiences with us?
Sure.
How did it progress from there?
It progressed up on through the past maybe about 6 or 7 years now. And the last ones were basically just a contact type thing to let me know, I think, that they're still here. They're around. I wasn't taken at that point. I just saw them. But prior to that, one of the main events that Kathleen Martin did a full investigation on, actually went out and drove the area, was in Colorado, August of 1982. And we lived in the Denver area in Colorado, but we had a campsite shared with about 100 others on a ranch. And it was backed by BLM land of about 1,800 acres on the Arkansas River. And we were allowed to wander all of that. Lots of Ute Indian stuff that was left that we found, lots of arrowheads, things like that, tools. But anyway, we were leaving one night. We always left in daylight because it was about a 3-hour trip. So we left and we went up to the top of a pass that looked down on a little town called Jefferson. And it was also called South Park. Big Glacier Valley.
South Park.
Like, South Park. You're, yeah.
Did you
correct.
Find out who killed Kenny? Or?
I didn't. I wish I had.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's all right. So at that point, we got out of the car and stood looking over the valley. There's just one ranch at the far end at the time. And it took, an hour and a half to cross it. Maybe a little more depended. So my parents were there waiting for us. They had a campsite also. We each had little mobile homes. It was well before the big RV thing. So we each had mobile homes set up. And we got back in the car, and I noticed off to my left in the valley these odd-looking lights. Well, there was no road there, so I wondered what was going on. They were pretty large. And as we drove down to the valley floor, the lights started to come toward us. And they came pretty rapidly. I remembered passing the little town, and about 4 miles outside that town, the lights had hit the road area. And there were, in that section, wooden snow barriers. And they also kept in the summertime these huge tumbleweed from coming across and hitting a car or a truck at night because they wouldn't see it till it was too late. So these snow barriers trapped all of that. So I'm looking at the lights and watching that snow barrier. And pretty soon, fairly quickly, the lights ended up over the top of our car. So I rolled the window down and I stuck my head out and looked up. Our daughter and little dog was in the back. They were sound asleep at that point, which my daughter was usually excited to go to camp. And so I wondered, what are they doing asleep? Stuck my head out the window, looked up, and there was this enormous something dark over the top of us. Before I could think it any further, I felt the car move, and it was moving to the left and lifting. It was lifted over the snow barrier, out into that glacier valley, and then slowly set down. And then I saw the lights of a craft come over the hood of the car and sit in front of us. And it was a very unusual-looking craft. If you took two dinner plates and touched them bottom to bottom, then the rest that curved out, the curvature, is what it looked like. And the center where they would attach were just a jillion lights, all sparkling.
So going back, they picked you up off of the road and took you into a field?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
And this craft landed in front of us, and I soon saw just an odd change formation that it made. The two dishes shaped folded over the centerpiece. So it was now kind of round, still some lights in the middle. And some entities stepped out and took me into the craft. I did not have a lot of memory of what went on in there. It was an examination, for one thing. But I had some hypnosis work done by Kathleen Martin, and we started to discover what went on in the craft and so forth. The next thing we knew, we were on the other side by what was called the Collegiate Peaks on an area called Trout Creek Pass. It was pitch dark. Our headlights were on, the motor was running, but we were parked off to the side. And my husband was just kind of staring straight ahead with his hands grasping the wheel, and you could see the fear in his face. And he said to us, to me, "What just happened? What's going on?" And very confused and kind of conflicted in his emotions, wanting to protect the family, not knowing what to do next. And he said, "What was that?" And since I had been taken before, but still had kind of blurry pictures of what had happened and just occurred, I said, "I don't know. Do you think it was a UFO?" Mm-hmm. And he just kind of looked, and then he said, "You know, we better head for camp. Let's do that." So we pulled off the road and onto the road, and we were probably 7 to 9 miles away from camp, through the town of Buena Vista. And so we drove and saw pretty soon the road that we would turn into. And when we did, there were my parents and a family friend walking up to the caretaker's home of the ranch. They were going to ask to use the phone. There's no cell phones in 1982 that you could. So they were going to call hospitals. They were going to call the police departments, because there's only one road from Denver into this, no real side trips, because the town of Jefferson was right there on the edge of the road, all that type of thing. So, and my dad was going to get in the car with our friend and start driving to Denver. They had come from a crossroad in Colorado Springs. So there was nothing except that one road that they intersected. And just as they were going to do that and use the phone first, they saw headlights coming of our car as we pulled in, and we saw them and so stopped. And they said, "What, are you all right? You've never come in the dark before." No, we hadn't. We were always on time. And they were starting to wonder if we'd gotten off the road, something happened to the car, but it was a new car. So we said, "No." And Ed said, that's my husband, "Let me check the odometer." He liked to be very specific about things when he purchased something new. So he had set the odometer, and there was a lot of missing miles, just didn't exist. So, of course, we needed to find out whether the odometer was working or not. It was fine. But we missed the whole crossing of South Park.
What about time? Was it, were there missing? Obviously, there's missing time. If you
missing time. Parents. Yeah. But yeah, two and a half hours, approximately. Yeah. So it was probably closer to three. But here we are. My mom was the type that she had to know. She had a need to know, always very curious. And she said, "What happened? What happened?" And I said, "I don't know." "We have to know. You've been gone for X amount of time. You need to tell me." Well, my dad worked in aerospace and had a clearance. And he said, "Mom, let's go back to this later. Leave her alone." So he could keep a secret like no one I've ever met. So it was between the two of them, and my mom would try and sneak it. "What happened? What happened?" So I described the lights and told her about them, and she really didn't comment. She was just interested, fascinated with what had happened, and, you know, said, "Glad you're okay." Sitting around the fire, we had a group of people that would come over and talk, and that was the topic. Where had we been? What was going on? And so after that, that one event caused us both to question and wonder, and I felt like something was left out, something I needed to know. So I called and volunteered as a hypnosis subject. for a doctor, mm-hmm. Dr. Romek. And I drove over, and he was working on pain control, some other things that would help people that they could take care of themselves. Oh, smoking cessation was another one. So he said, let me see. Would you make a good subject? And he tested me, and I was an excellent subject, mm-hmm. not even knowing this is what was going to happen, because I wasn't even sure about hypnosis at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he said, what would you like from this experience? And I said, I would like to quit smoking. I was a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the best way is not to put a Band-Aid on any situation, including the event we had, because the Band-Aid's going to wear off and you're going to have to do it again. Yeah. So let me ask you.
Okay. Let me interrupt you.
Sure.
For a moment. I need to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with experiencer and author Denise Stoner. Okay, I apologize for the interruption. Go ahead.
That's all right. So he asked me, do you want to quit smoking? And I said, yes. So he induced the hypnosis and asked me again, do you want to quit smoking? No. I really don't. And he said,
Your subconscious is telling him the truth, right?
It was. So he said, well, let's find out some reasons. Why do you not want to quit smoking? And I came up with 22 different reasons. And he said, we're going to spend time and eliminate these one at a time down the line. So after the second visit to him, I never touched another cigarette.
Really?
Yeah.
You went right through the 22, or the list of 22?
I did. It was very quick. Wow. Very quick.
Huh?
I would spend about 2 hours with him at a time in his office. So at one point, I mentioned being a little fearful of something that happened to me. And the smoking kind of eased and calmed that.
Mm-hmm.
Nervous, anxious feeling. So he said, well, and what was that event? And I started to tell him. Well, it turned out he was fascinated with the whole thing. And he said, would you like to work with me? I worked with him for 5 years, exploring, researching the best we could. He taught me how to use hypnosis. It was an extremely, the best time, I think, for beginning this research and all the events that occurred with me and others. Mm-hmm. So he has passed away, mm-hmm. but had devoted his life as a psychologist to discovering new ways to help when other things did no good. So I have to give him credit for that. That sent me on a voyage because in 1985, we moved to Florida. And my husband's dad had his medical practice here. And so he wanted to spend some time, you know, really getting to know him, but she hadn't. As a child, they always lived many states apart. So we moved here. So my goal was, I'm going to become a scuba diver. That will keep me from missing Colorado and my friends and so forth. It was a deep sense of homesickness. When we moved here. So I took the scuba diving, and my husband said, I'll take it with you, but as soon as we're done, I'm out of it. Well, he stayed. He took the test. We stayed. He got hooked. We moved on to become scuba instructors. We taught for several years. And then I said, you know, I've been in those caverns, which means a cavern, you can still see the light, the exit. Mm-hmm. I wonder what happens past that, beyond that. Took cave diving, and the new computers were up. They were beginning to use mixed gases. I wanted to do some deep wreck diving also. But finding these sinkholes and places to dive took the type of direction, finding the place, locating it is where you take a left at this farmer's barn and a right at that fence, and there's a tree there, and you turn into the woods, and then you find where you're going. So we, at one point, were on our way to go diving one morning. We stopped by a farmer's barn. Both of us looked. Kathleen took our drawings of what we thought we saw. We each saw something different, these objects that were behind the barn. I saw them as one thing, nothing real, nothing that belonged behind that farmer's barn. My husband thought they were something else. But then he said he felt like he was going under some sort of anesthesia, kind of uncontrolled type of thing mentally, where he just felt enclosed in our truck. And all of a sudden, he came to, he was still at the stop sign that was there. There were no traffic. And here comes this entity that he drew, carrying me back to the truck. And the door was already open. He watched it put me down in the seat and then disappeared. And I came to right away.
He was conscious during that time, right?
Yeah. So we did go diving. We talked an awful lot about what had happened. I recalled some of the parts of that I had been taken to a craft that was on the ground. And in North Florida, where we were, there was a lot of farmers' fields and vacant property and areas where there was either spring hammock, which means there's water somewhere in the ground that causes a lot more growth of tropical situation. And then the other is a dry, where it's mostly pine trees. And that's where I was taken, to an area where a lot of pines and dry ground. And I remember just visiting and being shown some things, being told some things.
Can you share that with
me? Yeah. They always wanted to test something, always, on me physically. So they poked around with a needle type affair. I'd had that before. And sometimes they would stick it in the back of my leg, a couple of times into the navel. And I actually had sent Kathleen a picture of those areas where I woke up on the floor next to my bed once, and I had a little bit of fluid and a little bit of blood in the navel area and a big bruise. And I felt like they had dropped me on that occasion. They missed the bed, and I hit the floor, and that's what woke me up. That's what they were doing, basically, that time.
Okay. Well, other than your own, I'm sure you have some more personal experiences to share, but other than your own, what are the most compelling case, what is the most compelling case you have ever investigated?
Ever investigated? I'll give an example of one. It was a gentleman that called me. He was an engineer, and he was very distressed, distraught over some things that had happened to him. And I asked him what was going on to try and get an idea, taking notes of what was happening to him. Did he have any mental issues? We have to look for that. No, he was very exact that at least every other month he would wake up in his garage on the floor on his back. And he couldn't figure it out. He recalled being very fearful when he went to bed. And he would, like many others are discovering, that he would have like a tinnitus ringing in the ears, but another additional sound. And he felt like, tomorrow morning I'm not going to wake up in my bed. So at one point he felt that His hand was on his abdomen, and he felt that kind of sticky feeling that I had, that there's something there. Was he bleeding? Brought his hand up, and yes, there was blood. And then he realized the top of his head was hurting. So he felt around and found at the top of his head, in the center, was an open area of skin. So he got his camera, he got a mirror, he took a picture, and there was a Y-shaped incision on the top of his head.
Why?
The skin was still open. So when that occurred, that's when he decided he was going to call somebody and found me. So we set up some cameras, we did some research, and we could not capture anything. He learned to deal with that over time. But in the meantime, in the interim, I had taken that photograph. I shared it with Kathleen. I shared it with a couple of others that I knew documented those type of situations. And we found a couple of others that matched. And it was odd because the parties had the same type of hair style. It was kind of dark brown, curly. The Y incision was in the same place. They did not know each other. They were separated by many states. And so we have not had any more of that for quite a while. But that's not something that some bad guy that comes to rob you is going to do to you. You know, it's highly unusual. He recalled seeing entities always walking away and then fading right into the garage door.
You say cameras. Did he set up cameras? Anybody set up cameras in his bedroom? And
he set up one. He never captured anything. In fact, a lot of the times, I think it was twice with him, that the cameras were shut down when he woke up.
That's what I was going to ask. That happens all the time.
It
and
does.
Skeptics say, "Oh, isn't that convenient? The camera shut down." Unable to. That happens.
It does.
All the time.
It certainly does.
You're aware of our cameras and what they do. And
yes.
That's a no-no.
That's a no-no. We have found something for researching Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and possibly these grays. If you make a Faraday cage with little tiny copper wires around your camera, leave the lens exposed, for some reason they don't see it or notice it. So we're beginning to explore the possibilities of finally capturing something using that method. I have suggested it.
Yeah, so can you use that method on a camera for this gentleman that potentially sleepwalked?
Yeah, I've told him, and I am hoping that he will follow through. He is the type that would. He's curious, but he wants to help himself. So we're going to see what happens. Just go and purchase the tiniest little copper wire at Lowe's, Home Depot, and just wrap it and leave open what you need to show. And it seems to be beginning to help. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens there. We had, I don't know if very many people have heard of a city called Casadega. It's a spiritualist camp where people are trained in methods of doing readings for people, that kind of thing. Well, this spiritualist camp is here in Florida, and the hotel is very haunted. However, two women that I had call me also had gone to spend the weekend in the hotel. And they thought they were going on a ghost hunt. But they did set up a camera in their bedroom that night just to see if maybe a ghost or spirit would show. And the second night, they were too tired after all the daily activities and the night before to go on the nighttime, the last night ghost hunt. So they went to sleep. One of them felt strange and felt like she barely hit the side of the bed before she was out. They woke up the next morning to check the camera, and you can see what looks like the half face of a gray, leaning over and shutting that camera down.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting photo. It was not a ghost.
I want to get ghost paranormal and the connection or not connection with ET, but I want to take another moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell, your host, and we're speaking with author and experiencer, hypnotist, and wears many hats, Denise Stoner.
Okay, thank you.
Let's talk about the paranormal. Would the UFO, UAP phenomenon fit into paranormal realms as we know it?
I have to say yes, along with others. And the how of it and the why of it, we don't know. But the how of it is we have orbs, and I'm going to give you a really good example of what an orb can be versus a dust orb.
Yes.
And first of all, I will tell you that I have had a case for years. Both individuals involved in the case are retired Coast Guard captains.
Mm-hmm.
They normally won't speak of anything like that, but following retirement, they're good friends. And so one had been invited to go to dinner at the other's home. And while she was walking around, figuring out what they were going to eat, what could they eat outside? It was Florida. Was it going to be too warm or rainy, etc.? So she walked outside in her back patio, and she has a small pond there. And she looked, and at first she thought it was something to do with the water in the pond. But there was a football-shaped blue orb that was sparkling, and it was above the water, and she was standing right on the edge of this, and she thought, oh my goodness, what is that? Started to walk off to one side, got a kind of a message, don't go any further. She came back to the front of it, and when she did, it exploded into a blue being, hands, feet, arms. And they were kind of moving towards her, and she thought, uh-oh, I better just go in, watch through the sliding glass doors. I don't know what I should do. Should I get my camera? Decided to get her camera. Went in through the sliding glass doors. And on the floor, she was getting ready to have her friend come for dinner and help her out with a very old TV set. So the big, heavy, clunky kind. It hadn't worked for years. Mm-hmm. Was sitting there by the door. So she went outside again. And as she did, it's almost like this being knew she was going to take a picture, and it imploded back into the football shape and shot straight into the air and disappeared.
Wow.
It moved very fast. She did not get a picture. She tried. But her friend arrived. They went inside, and both of them, very analytical and scientific, had to know what was going on. As they walked through the sliding glass doors, that TV turned on, and it was not plugged in.
Aha!
Yeah.
So
there's an example of what an orb can turn into,
yeah.
And that would be something to do with possible ETs, UFO, etc. So we pull in another example where we have a home with spirits. They have been seen, and they show up first as orbs. Mm-hmm. And they let the individual know they're around. They buzz around, and they have little tails, some of them. You can tell they're intelligently controlled, but they're not ETs. Some of them have faces, like a little spirit. It's got an eyes, nose, mouth, that can form. They do some of the little ghostly things, moving objects, making sounds like footsteps, those types of things. And they can come in close connection to an event with a UFO.
Close connection.
I don't want to use the word connection. Close in timing, let's put it that way, in timing with that event. So
it's very easy to get the two phenomena confused, yes?
Oh, yes. Individuals that have looked at their bedroom door knew something was coming, heard it, and in walks a gray. The next time, it's not a gray. It's some kind of spirit. You can see through it. It's pulling some of the stunts that people, you know, spirits will pull, lifting something up, floating something around, saying, I'm here, I'm using your energy, the lights can flash on and off, all of that type of thing.
Well, so how do we know if we see an orb, is that ET or is that spirit, as a rule?
As a rule, I guess the only thing a person can do is observe, be very observant of the behavior of the orb.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the ones that are spirit-bound and controlled intelligently by some spirit will have a little tail on it, and it will fly.
As it's moving
yeah.
Along? Yeah.
Yes.
Kind of like afterburner, right?
Right, that would be it, an afterburner. And they kind of buzz around and show off, and it's almost like they're trying to use the energy in the room to fully manifest, which is very difficult and very uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
They don't often show up, and they're able to soak up all the energy. That's where the cold spots come from.
Right.
It's they're soaking up that energy, and ET will not do that. They don't need to.
Okay, well, that's a good guide. And speaking of ET, has ET shared any knowledge with you or predictions about our planet or theirs?
Yes, and very much like others have received that we are a very dangerous, warlike bunch of creatures.
Right.
And
Agreed.
Yeah, and we are dangerous to others and ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I was told that this planet, Earth, is an oasis for many, and that we contain a lot of the minerals, the gems, water, you name it, that they need to use in their travels. It's a stopover a lot of the time, and we are destroying it. Others have heard all of that. We need to do something to correct our actions, or it's going to be too late. And that's very, very close now to occurring, that people sense a coming of, they call it the shift, for one thing, what's going to happen to the Earth. The ETs have told me and others that they could share so much with us in the usage of their technology, and because we're dangerous, they won't do it. We would use it the wrong way.
Right. Well, I agree with that. There's a thing about President Eisenhower having met with ETs and trying to make a deal with us. They were trying to make a deal with us to share this information
right.
with us. In exchange for abductees or whatever
yes.
it was.
Yes.
Do you believe that?
I do, and here's why. I like to back up what I say. Years ago, I spoke to Paul Hellyer, the Minister of Defense of Canada, for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So he was working, he was on the job at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been able to acquire information.
Mm-hmm.
And he told my studies, a wonderful man, and why would someone like that step out of their position and then go on to tell these stories? He told me that was actual fact, and that they were to take 13 basic orphans. They had to be people that didn't have families. They altered their social security numbers and gave them 3 numbers. They were volunteers, and one ET was to stay here. So they boarded, and it was to be a 10-year episode. Well, time and so forth is warped. So 13 years later, they begin to return. Mm-hmm. He told me one stayed on the planet. I think he said one died on the planet of some sort of radiation sickness. One refused to come back. He was not going to come back to the...
Was it a human?
Yes, these are humans. These are of the 13. Okay. The others came back, and for the rest of their lives, they weren't exactly what we would call normal, but it was due to their experience, and they really valued their privacy. They had a lot of secrets to keep, and basically that's what he stood and told me. The ET, however, that was giving us a little bit of information on how to improve our technology, mm-hmm. Thought, well, these people signed a contract. We're not obligated to abide by that contract. Hmm. Paul told me that also. We can do as we wish, as long as we don't bring it too far over the edge, left of center. And they continued to take, abduct people, humans, at their will.
But basically they don't keep them.
We
humans. I had Paul Hellyer on the show quite a while ago. Of course, he's passed now.
Yes.
But what was he, 98 or something, 99?
Yeah, somewhere right in there, yes. Yeah.
But I probably asked him about this, this treaty that Eisenhower had. But I don't remember what he said. I know he didn't tell me what you just told me.
That was an in-person, face-to-face that I was so lucky to have.
Yeah,
very lucky.
It's very honest with me, Paul Hellyer.
Yeah.
And he wants people to know, you know.
Yeah, he was very serious about that. And he said, and I don't know if he told you this or not, probably, that he had some sort of event or something in his life that made him very curious. Mm-hmm. And as the Minister of Defense and with the clearances, he had the right to ask questions like that.
Well, sure.
And when he did, paperwork started flooding into his desk to read that explained some of this type of thing with the UFOs and visitors. And he read more than he was able to tell.
Yeah. Here in America, everything is so compartmentalized that one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing.
No.
But in Canada, where he was, asks a question, he gets an answer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and, he absolutely did. A lot of it from the military.
John Greenwald told me that he couldn't get certain documents on certain cases and everything from the, even with the Freedom of Information Act, he couldn't get it from our government. But knowing that our government shared with Canada its secrets,
yeah,
he just went over to Canada and said, I need information on this. They said, okay, and gave it to him.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Yes. It doesn't make any sense. And I've been to a couple of briefings because I worked for the government, and then I worked for Department of Defense, and doing the investigations that I did for new recruits, I had to have a type of clearance because I also taught first aid and CPR for the nuclear power school. So to enter that building, you could not just walk in. Mm-hmm. So I had two briefings that I recall on what clearances are all about, what was expected, and it's, to me, just crazy. Mm. Because if you're handed a folder, for example, and there's something in it that you have a need to know and you're responsible for, if you're going to go to lunch, or you are going to use the restroom, or you're going to whatever, and you cannot take that folder with you, then you have to sit down and figure out who has a need to know and who can take it from you for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes on and on and on, overly protected, and a lot of the time that information gets out anyway.
Yeah. When I was in the army, I was in Germany, and I was in the secret vault, handling secrets. And some of those secrets are like, what did you have for dinner yesterday?
True.
Things that, who cares if the Russians know it, you know? And I was told if some of these these top secret documents were back in the United States, they'd be classified as, I don't know, rumors or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now you say that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
You say that we're destroying our planet and ET is concerned about that and we should do something about it. Okay. Can they do something about it?
I remember being told they could, but they will not, unless we are going to affect the universe. And if it comes to that, something extreme in the nuclear power situation, then they would step in. But otherwise, mm-mm. And they gave examples, and well, as a scuba diver, I saw it, and this was back when, before I retired from that. So I would say 1997, the coral reefs were dying.
Oh, yes.
We're killing them. We're killing the fish. We're poisoning the oceans. So start there and move on to our farms and the way we use food and how we grow it and how we use electricity, everything. Every single thing that we do is wrong.
Yeah, I'll bet you. And
yeah.
And they don't want to bring in the alternative energies, clean energies, windmills, and what have you, because they distract from the view and kill the whales, and come on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. It's so ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
But
I often ask my guests this, if we started a nuclear war, would ET step in? And they seem to, I won't tell you what they say. What do you say?
I say that it's going to have to be a pretty drastic situation if they're going to blow up a part of a country or a specific area that's small. I don't think so. But if it got larger and everybody's going to blow everybody out of the sky, I think I was told they would. I do.
Yeah, at the same time, I don't think they would wait or should wait until it gets that drastic. Because once a nuclear device goes over on a missile from one country to the other, you know the other's going to retaliate back and forth and back and forth. And like the movie War Games.
Right.
There's no win.
No, there's no win. What in the world are we thinking? We're just volunteering ourselves to murder our own along with others, and I don't think that's going to happen. I don't believe that I was told that. They're going to step in. They know what we're doing.
Yeah.
They're watching us very closely.
Well, I hope you're right.
And I hope I am too.
That is exactly what other guests have told me. And I guess I keep wanting to get reaffirmment of that.
Yeah, like when are they coming?
When
are they coming? I'd like to know to put in that appearance. But then they have to be aware that we're not going to blow them out of the sky as they come in, because there's a lot of shoot 'em down orders.
When that order for shoot 'em down came down, was Truman made that order, shoot 'em down, because they they were seen over his house. He didn't like that.
Yeah.
But when that order came down, he put that order down to shoot him down.
Yeah.
Lost a lot of Air Force personnel.
That's
they
true.
They will not attack us, but they will defend themselves.
No. And one thing, and I can't really tell you why or where, but somewhere out west, there is a specific area where these crafts leave, so enter and exit. And for the shoot 'em down orders, since we know basically where that is, we are getting stupid in shooting some of those down because some of them are returning humans. So they're not considering the fact that we've got someone of our own on board that craft.
Yeah. So actually, we do have down craft that we took down that they are trying to back engineer and take human bodies out of it. Oh, sorry about that, but,
Very sad.
Very stupid.
Shoot them first and ask questions, not.
Not, who cares? Right.
Yeah.
And there's also this this thing about false flag operation that is supposed to occur.
Yeah, and someone that I know that's an author, I'm not going to name him because wouldn't be fair without him here to speak. At one point, I was on a kind of a panel radio show, and he was talking about various and sundry things, and I said, what about your book? He was going to name it False Flags. And what was his remark? I chickened out.
Really?
Yeah.
But a lot of people are not chickening out. Carol Rosen, for example, worked with, now I'm forgetting his name, drawing a blank.
Ooh.
German scientist.
Oh my goodness. See, now we're both doing it.
But she was told that, I wish I could think of a thing. She was told that we would have a false flag operation with, ET's going to attack us and even drop bombs and kill people, our own people, and blame it on ET so that we'd be afraid of them when it's not ET at all.
No. We're doing a lot of that type of thing that could come about. Also distractions. Pulling something so we're not looking in direction where things are going on that need to be noticed and statements made about. So much of all of this going on, it's false flags and more.
Magician sand, huh? Watch what's going on in my left hand so you don't see what's going on in my right hand.
Exactly, yeah. Diversionary tactics are being used more and more and more.
We have covered so much, and yet there's so much from you to cover. I hope we can get together again in the near future and talk.
Oh, absolutely. This is fantastic. I loved our exchange.
Yes, this is nice. And are there any, quickly though, are there any books in the offing? Any more books in the offing?
I'm doing some research right now, so I don't know, will that turn into a book? It might. I can't say for sure just yet.
Mm-hmm. Very secretive.
Very secretive right now, yes.
You talk about a lot of cases in your other book.
Yes.
The Alien Abduction Files, which people can get anywhere.
Right? Yes.
And you'll probably be more such files, right?
More such, and how it's changed. What is different? Mm-hmm. Because it is.
And where can our listeners go to find out more about your work?
I don't have a website. It was hacked. So right now, use dmstoner1@gmail.com. Contact me. I'll respond. But say something in the subject line so I'm not thinking it. Yeah.
I always tell people, put UFO in the subject line so I don't just delete it.
Excellent.
Excellent is right. Okay. Denise Stoner, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a good one.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, This is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.